This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 or on the web at radiocab.net. And also a grant from Portland's Gay and Lesbian Community Yellow Pages, providing a wide variety of gay-friendly business listings. More information at 503-230-7701 or www.pdxgayyellowpages.com.
Is there water?
Yes, there is. Hello. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming out. It is a pretty full crowd, so if there's any way for people to kind of scrunch in so that some of the aisles are clear,
Holy shit.
We need to have some sort of semblance of some aisles in here. Before we get started, I just want to remind you of the some of the other events that we have. You can look online at pals.com to check on our upcoming events and also read our newsletter, Inc. Some of the other events that we have coming up this month include evenings with Tim Winton, Jennifer Vanderveer, Mary Roach, Adam Gopnik, and many others. Tonight we're happy to welcome back Dan Savage. His newest book, The Commitment, is his own personal story about his struggles on the subject of gay marriage. While his parents and others approve of the idea, his own 6-year-old son, DJ, does not. Savage finds out that talking marriage with his son is just as hard as reasoning with a stubborn Republican. Nationally, of course, the debate on gay marriage rages on and becomes a prime subject in the political spectrum. As Savage considers the marriages of his friends and family, the scary views of James Dobson, and what kind of cake he would have at a gay wedding, the importance of love and commitment come into clearer view, even if his own son is the last to come around. Please welcome a Powell's favorite, Mr. Dan Savage.
So scary. When you write for a living, I'm sure all the writers here know that you don't see human beings ever. You're like, it's so solitary, it's so lonely, it's so boring. And then you get to go on a book tour and suddenly there are all these people clapping. And the only people you saw while you were writing the book were, you know, people in porn sites that you... when you need to pause and reflect, you'd go look at some porn. And no one ever applauded for you when you were finished at the porn site. Actually, it's really fun to be in Portland, not just because the Mercury is so awesome and I'm so proud to be a part of the Mercury. And Steve Humphrey is here of the Mercury. Give him a round of applause. But what's really terrific about getting to come to Portland and having such like an amazing crowd, they told me downstairs I couldn't come up because they were at capacity. I had to tell them that if I didn't come up, there would be a riot. What's really great about getting to come to Portland and read is that I wrote most of this book here in Portland. Portland's my secret writing spot, because you can't write if you have a child and a partner. So I would come here for a couple of weeks at a time and stay at the Mallory and eat nothing but cheeseburgers at Ringler and drink beer. So for old time's sake, tonight for this book, I went to Ringler's and had 4 pints of beer. So you get the drunk version of the reading. and it's great to be here, oh my God. I want to read a couple of little chunks of this book, and then we'll have a Q&A, because that's usually the most fun part of a reading, and Q&A is my preferred format and everything. And I want to preface the reading by saying that the book didn't start out as a book about gay marriage or a book about me, it's all about me. It didn't start out as a sort of quasi-sequel to The Kid. It started out as a book about my great-grandparents' house. How exciting is that? I grew up sort of the last of, I think, white middle-class-ish, sort of working-class middle-class-ish Americans to grow up in a multi-generational household. My great-grandparents bought a two-apartments, flat-roof, Chicago sort of style house, and they brought up their eight kids in one of the apartments while another relative brought up her eight kids in another one of the apartments. There were 20 adults, six bedrooms, two bathrooms. And then my grandmother's generation brought up her, she brought up her six kids while upstairs another relative brought up her six kids. So there were 16 adults, or 16 humans in three, six bedrooms, two bathrooms. And then my mother's generation brought up her four kids in this house, so us. And isn't that just the history of the Irish in America? Eight kids, six kids, four kids, one kid. And I wanted to write, I wanted to document this because people don't live like that in America anymore. White middle class people don't live like that in America anymore. And there are good things about it and bad things about it. So I wrote about 50,000 words on this house. And then November 4th last year when George Bush got reelected. I guess, do you guys know that George Bush got reelected? It's... How are we going to live through the next 3 years and 3 months of this fucker? But anyway, he got reelected, and my editor, who had been reading all the pages I've been sending about my grandparents' house, and writing about my grandparents' house really required me, because what did the house house? What did the house house but all these relationships, all these marriages, all these families over these generations of my family? So I had to write about my great-grandparents' family, and my grandparents' family, and my parents' family, and a little bit about my family, and how we fit in or didn't fit into this idea of a multi-generational household, or the flow of these generations of my family. So he called me after the election and said, the book is now about gay marriage. Which in 2004 was kind of the unavoidable topic. And so it sort of made sense. Anyway, it morphed into this book about me. Without really me intending to do that. Anyway, one of the problems I think you face if you write about yourself sort of as a parent or a family unit is that you're constantly filleting yourself about what a good parent you are. I had a piece excerpted from this book in the New York Times Modern Love column in Sunday Styles, which is a real thrill because it's a real terrific column, I think. And, of course, they excerpted this piece about what a thoughtful, sensitive parent I am. And so, in case any of you saw that, I kind of feel honor-bound to read this chunk of the book about what a shitty parent I am. Because all parents are good and bad, I think, in roughly equal measure. So I'd like to read this little chunk of the book that I can't read in Seattle, and that one day will require my son to have oodles of therapy, because one day he's going to read this. It's called The Long Drive Home. And even this has to be set up. My boyfriend and I went on a road trip in the summer of 2004 during this whole gay marriage hoo-ha, because we were sick of it. And we drove from Vashon Island, where we live, up in Washington and Seattle, to Michigan and back, which required driving through every fucking red state in America. And what we discovered, besides that it's hot in South Dakota in the summer, is that... You can. I didn't think it was possible, but a gay family can drive through the red states and survive. It's a little like being on an African safari. You're safe so long as you stay in the fucking car. And this is just a little chunk of the road trip, but I'll read it for you. It's called The Long Drive Home. I was convinced that there would be a knock on the door and we would both be arrested. We were spending the night in a small motel in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, that shared a parking lot with an enormous Home Depot. Seattle was still days away, and Terry, he who has to do all the driving, H-W-H-T-D-A-T-D, if you read Savage Love, you know how I love acronyms, H-W-H-T-D-A-T-D, had collapsed into bed the moment we opened the door to our room, despite the fact that Dan, he who reminds Terry every morning that we could have flown to Michigan, H-W-R-H-T-E-M-T-W-C-H-F-T-M, was just as exhausted as H-W-H-T-D-A-T-D. It was H-W-R-T-E-M-T-W-C-H-F-T-M who got stuck with walking the damn poodle and getting DJ into PJs. The damn poodle, I need to tell you what that's about. Having two gay dads isn't trial enough for a young gay young child, so we got him a poodle. We wanted to make damn sure he got beat up every day in high school. Actually, this embarrasses me. Like, as a gay man, the last thing I ever expected to have was a poodle. That was like the one gay sexually transmitted disorder you could avoid. But DJ had a friend who had straight parents who bred poodles, which is like the gayest sounding thing in the world, even though there's nothing sexual about it. And so he decided he had to have a poodle too, which is how our son ended up getting a dog that makes me feel gayer for the owning of it. So anyway, DJ has a poodle, and I'm still not reconciled to it. HWHTDATD refuses to believe that being the passenger on a long road trip is anywhere near as tiring as being a driver. HWRTDMTWCHFTM begs to differ. For while HWHTDATD sits in the driver's seat concentrating on the road ahead and blocking out everything that's going on inside the car, HWRTEMTWCHFTM has to keep the 6-year-old in the back seat entertained, which requires him to spend a lot of time twisted around in his seat, loading movies into a portable DVD player, offering snacks, and cleaning up spills. HWRTEMTWCHFTM also acts as valet and butler to HWHTDATD, getting him drinks and snacks, reading maps for him, and feeding CDs into the car stereo. And HWRTEMTWCHFTM is never allowed to put a CD in that he might like to listen to. The driver picks the music, says HWHTDATD. If you want to pick the music, learn to drive. After 10 hours on the road, Terry, I shall retire the acronyms now, and I were barely speaking, so I was actually somewhat relieved when he went right to sleep. But then in my hurry to get to bed, I made what turned out to be a fatal mistake. Instead of making DJ take a shower before bed, after we had walked the dog around a couple of sad-looking shrubs in the Home Depot parking lot, I decided to let him take one in the morning before breakfast. This was a mistake, a big mistake. DJ had been sitting in a warm car all day long. Air conditioning can only do so much in July in the Midwest. And the combination of a 6-year-old wipe job after a truck stop bathroom break and all that sweat and inactivity had tragic and far-reaching consequences. Diaper rash. Diaper rash on a kid who'd been out of diapers for 4 years. Now, I have felt like an incompetent parent on plenty of occasions. I didn't feel too bright, for instance, the time I left my overnight bag sitting open on the kitchen floor after returning home from a trip. After using the bathroom, I walked back into the kitchen to discover my 2-year-old son gnawing on a full bottle of Xanax, looking for all the world like he was playing the lead in a preschool production of Valley of the Dolls. If the bottle had cracked open or in his mouth, or if he'd managed to chew the lid off, DJ would have been overdosed and quite possibly died before we got him to an emergency room. Perhaps Patty Duke could have played the ER doctor who saved his life and turned his parents into Child Protective Services. And then there was the time I accidentally put a $5 bill under DJ's pillow. His first baby tooth had fallen out earlier in the day, and it was up to me, the insomniac parent, to replace the tooth under his pillow with a $1 bill in the middle of the night. In the dark, I took a fiver out of my pocket and put that under his pillow. This mistake not only set an expensive precedent, it also earned me the lasting resentment of the parents of all of DJ's friends. And then there was the time I almost taught DJ how to set fire to the house. That won't win me any parenting prizes. We have a fireplace, and DJ likes to help bring in the wood, bunch up newspapers, and stuff them under logs when it's time to have a fire. Clearly not thinking, one day when DJ was 4 or 5, I started to show him how to perform the final task. Here's how you light a match, son. Luckily, Terry was standing right there beside me. He won't win any parenting prizes for shouting, "What the fuck are you doing?" at the top of his lungs, forever expanding DJ's vocabulary. But his outburst stopped me from showing DJ how to play with matches. We made a big production number out of the serious talk we needed to have about the word fuck. How it's only appropriate to use that word when something terrible happens. In the hopes that using the word fuck would seem like a larger, more tempting taboo than setting all the newspapers on fire in the living room. But my son waking up howling in the middle of the night with diaper rash at age 6? A shameful new low. What kind of parents let their 6-year-olds get diaper rash? abusive parents, neglectful parents, meth lab parents. But I hardly had time to beat myself up for allowing this to happen before the full horror of what was unfolding in our motel room began to dawn on me. Unlike most children who get diaper rash, pre-verbal infants, VJ has a full and colorful command of the English language. So he wasn't just sobbing, which would have merely annoyed people in nearby rooms. He was using his words. Divorced of their context, overheard in a neighboring motel room, DJ's words had to be alarming. "Ow!" he screamed, waking us both up. "My butthole hurts! Daddy, it hurts! Daddy! My butthole hurts! Make it stop! Ow!" The walls were thin. I had a hard time falling asleep earlier that night because I could hear the TV in the next room. And as we rushed DJ into the small bathroom, I worried that we weren't the only people DJ woke up, and that it sounded to all the world like a small child was being murdered in our room, or worse. And we're not even to the juicy dialogue yet. After taking a quick look at his butt, we realized what the problem was. DJ had the worst parents in the world and diaper rash in 86. A few seconds later, we were sitting on the bed, Terry holding DJ's arm so he couldn't cover his butt with his hands, as I attempted to pry DJ's clenched butt cheeks apart long enough to drag a wet, soapy, and unfortunately rough hotel washcloth across his burning asshole. This charming gay family tableau, DJ howling and thrashing and continuing to use his words, "Don't touch my butt, Daddy! It hurts! Stop touching my butthole, Daddy! Ow, 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 ow!" This gay family tableau would make Gary Bauer, Jerry Falwell, and other opponents of gay adoption howl at the top of their lungs, too. After I washed DJ's butt, it was Terry's turn to pry his butt cheeks apart so that he could apply some antibacterial ointment he brought along in his bag. As the screaming and sobbing and buttholes and daddies continued, I kept one eye on my suffering son and another on the door, waiting for the knock that would signal the arrival of the police. "It's not what it looks or sounds like, officers," I would say as the South Dakota SWAT team burst into the room. "It's just diaper rash and incompetent gay parenting, swear to God." But there was no knock on the door, not yet, anyway. Soon our poor traumatized son and his poor traumatized butthole began to settle. His butt still burned, but it was no longer on fire. The conflagration passed. Sitting on Terry's lap, tears drying on his face, DJ looked up. "Was that terrible?" asked DJ, sniffling. "Yes, it was," Terry assured him. "It was terrible. Terrible enough to say the F word?" Terry looked at me. I shrugged. "If not now, when?" "Fuck," DJ said, savoring the moment. "Fuck, fuck, fuck, fuck." Terry laughed and kissed DJ on the forehead. "If I gotta drive," HWHTDATD said, "I gotta sleep." Terry stood up and passed DJ to me and then treated me to an awesome display of one of his parental superpowers, the ability to fall instantly asleep no matter what the circumstances. With Terry snoring softly on my right, DJ cuddled up in the crook of my left arm and my heart still pounding against my ribcage, I lay in bed waiting for the knock on the door that I still expected to come. Surely the police, or whatever passes for child protective services in South Dakota, were on their way. I have a phone call. Never mind. Sorry about that. Turn off your cell phones. I won't turn off mine. Surely the police or whatever passes for Child Protective Services in South Dakota were on their way. After all that screaming, sobbing, and yelling about buttholes and daddies, how could they not be? Every minute that ticked away was a relief. Soon DJ was asleep. Unable to sleep myself, I flipped on CNN and caught up on the Scott Peterson trial. Gee, I thought to myself, maybe we lucked out. Maybe no one in the motel called the police. About an hour and a half later, almost 2 hours after DJ woke up screaming, My relief that no one had called the police was replaced by fury. A 6-year-old boy screams bloody murder in a motel room for 30 minutes and no one calls the police? What the fuck is wrong with people in South Dakota? So that's that little chunk of that chapter. Don't clap, makes me very nervous. And I want to read this other little chunk. It's actually getting me into trouble in certain circles, so it's fun to read. And then we'll have a little wee Q&A, and it'll be very fun. And I'm just reading scummy, funny parts of the book instead of, like, the sensitive, mawkish parts of the book that, like, This American Life is using and The Mercury is using. And because I can write mawkish, sentimental crap, but I can't read it out loud. This makes me nervous. If you're contemplating marriage, you, of course, have to contemplate the most important aspect of marriage, which is cake. And I have a chapter in the book called Five Cakes, which are the five cakes I thought about when I was thinking about marriage. And the subheaders are, there's green cake, there is peach cake, wedding cake, my cake, and there is kink cake. And I would like to read the kink cake chapter. Who knew that there's such a thing as kink cake? And I'll just get right to it. Then we can have a wee Q&A and it'll be fun. Being a sex advice columnist, particularly one who believes that people should enjoy their kinks, gives you a license to be nosy about other people's sexual interests. Take, for instance, the cake fetishist I met after giving a talk at a large university in the Midwest. Before I get to the cake fetishist, though, a word for all the advocates of abstinence education out there. Thanks. The brand of sex education you're pushing, so little useful information, so much misinformation, means I will never be out of a job. I get questions every day from teenagers who think they can't get pregnant the first time they have sex, and that you're still a virgin if you only have anal sex, in which case Terry can wear white if we decide to get married. And that you can contract AIDS just by walking into a banana republic. Since 18-year-old high school seniors don't magically become informed, sophisticated 18-year-old college freshmen the day their parents drop them off at the dorms, universities pay me thousands of dollars to come in and undo some of the damage done by abstinence education in an evening. It's a nice little sideline, and what I'm grateful for, I'm tempted to name my second home Abstinence Manor. When I do a speaking gig at a college, I take questions two ways. Students can raise their hands and ask questions in front of their friends and classmates, or they can write their questions down on 3x5 cards before the talk starts. Predictably, live questions tend to be about politics, and the anonymous cards tend to be about sex. At one particularly memorable gig, I got a question about how one reveals a secret kink to a presumably non-kinky partner. The person who wrote the question didn't mention what his or her kink was. If your mystery kink is extremely revolting or extremely rare, I said, offering up my boilerplate response to the what do I do about my kink question, you might want to use the internet to seek out a like-minded perv. But if it's something mild, something on the order of a foot fetish or a thing for being spanked, that's just info you share with your sex partners. But you need to present it to them like it's no big deal. If you don't present it like it's a problem, your partner is less likely to regard it as one. Present it as a perk, as if it were something that made you an even more fun, even more interesting sex partner than they already know you to be. After the talk, I noticed this impossibly good-looking guy lurking at the back of the auditorium. I could tell he wanted to ask me about something, but by the time I answered the questions of the other students who hung out after the talk, the good-looking lurker was gone. At this particular university, speakers are put up at a small on-campus hotel right off the quad, something the lurker apparently knew, because he was standing in the lobby when I got back to the hotel. He walked up and introduced himself. "I'm the one who asked the question about being kinky," he said. "The advice I gave wasn't helpful," he went on, "because his kink was both extremely rare and extremely mild." "So what's the kink?" I asked. He blushed and said he didn't want to say. I offered to give him some advice, but he would have to tell me what the kink it was we were talking about. Otherwise, he was wasting my time and his. He still couldn't bring himself to tell me, so I started rattling off kinks in a loud voice in the lobby of the hotel. feet, diapers, amputees, incest, piss, scat, BBWs, pegging, balloons, smokers, bondage, S&M. No, no, it wasn't anything like that, he said. He wasn't into anything extreme, he emphasized again. His fetish was actually kind of sweet. And it wasn't what his fetish was that was problematic, but that he'd never, ever heard of anyone else who shared his fetish. After making me promise not to tell anyone he knew, I didn't know anyone he knew, I pointed out. He confessed. He had a thing for birthday cake. Specifically, he got off on having birthday cakes smashed in his face.
I know what you're thinking.
He was pulling my leg. I assure you, dear reader, he wasn't. And we will get to exactly how I verified that in a moment. But I didn't... Ah, you must know him too. But I didn't doubt his fetish because it was actually a combo of two other well-known, if rarish, fetishes. There are people who get off on having pies smashed in their faces. It's a humiliation humor thing, the result of exposure to Three Stooges and Ringling Brother routines as a child. And there are people into wet and messy sex, or rolling around in baked beans, mud, condiments, whatever, and getting all sloppy, filthy, and harmlessly dirty during sex. Since I was familiar with both of these fetishes, although not intimately so, it didn't strike me as impossible that I was standing in a hotel lobby having a conversation with a straight boy who fantasized about pretty girls smashing birthday cakes in his face. After asking him if I could take notes, I began to lob questions at him. How long had he been into this?
Forever.
Had anyone ever hit him in the face with a cake as a child? Not that I remember. Did he have any special cake preferences? Layer, not sheet, they're thicker layer, so it takes longer for your face to go all the way through. Makes total sense. How old was he the first time he smashed a cake into his own face?
13.
How old was he the first time someone else smashed a cake into his face? He let out a little sigh.
No one else has ever done it to me, he said. My heart broke.
Really, it did. My heart broke when he told me that the one and only time he told a girlfriend about his fetish, she promptly dumped him. Since then, he'd been too afraid to tell anyone else. That girl was an idiot, I said. You're gorgeous. I'd smash a cake in your face in a heartbeat. With God as my witness, I swear it wasn't an offer. I meant it as a joke and a compliment. I wasn't making a pass at the handsome cake fetishist. He was straight, I was gay, it was late, I am not generally attracted to straight guys, and besides, it wasn't like I had a birthday cake up in my room. But his eyes lit up like a kid's on Christmas morning when I said I would smash a cake in his face, and I was completely unprepared for what he said next.
Do you mean it? He said.
Would you? Sure, I would. I mean, I guess. I mean, why not? I stammered. He looked so fragile, like he would shatter if I refused. But we don't have a cake, and I'm not exactly a pretty girl, and I have a really early flight.
I don't care that you're not a girl, he said. I will go get cake.
I mean, if you're serious, if you're not just making fun of me. What could I do? What would you do? What would Jesus do? Half an hour later, he was back at my hotel with not one, but two store-bought layer cakes. After an awkward few moments spent making small talk, I asked him if he still wanted to go through with this. I wanted to make sure that he wouldn't regret squandering his cake smashed in face virginity on a gay guy. He reassured me that he wanted to do this. He got undressed and knelt in the bathtub. I remained fully clothed. This was about his needs, not mine. From my end, this was research. Me, Jane Goodall, him, Chimp. Although the sight of this boy naked was reward enough for me. The girlfriend who dumped him was a fool, I told him as I lifted the lid off the cake. Now close your eyes and pretend I'm Hillary Swank. Thank you. No clap. Four beers before a reading, I have to urinate so badly. I'm going to have to drink all this and then pee in this bottle at the hotel. But you're not allowed to go urinate in the middle of a reading, so.
You also need a 1 liter bottle.
I need a 1 liter bottle, too. Unless I'm going to drink it halfway through and then pee some more. It's good for you. Gandhi did it. Any questions? This is the Q&A portion of the reading. You're a very important part of the Q&A. Without your cue, I have no A.
What do you do to protect your son from your stories and sex columns?
What do we do to protect my son from stories and sex columns? Which is getting more complicated now that he can read. We were so into like making him learn how to read. Now we're like, holy shit, we can't let him see The Stranger or The Mercury. You know, we put a little bit of money aside when I write chapters about his burning asshole so that he'll have plenty of therapy cash on hand when he's 15 years old and his high school buddies read this aloud to him one night when he's drunk. It's actually very easy to protect 7- and 8-year-olds from sexual writing because they don't care. I often get, because of Savage Love running in free papers, I'll get the letter that says, you know, little kids can find your column and read it, and you know, it's going to make them crazy, poop-eating, cake fetishists. And my stock response is always that little kids don't read sex columns because they don't care and it's gross and icky. And by the time a little kid wants to read about sex, they're old enough to read about sex, as far as I'm concerned, because the problem for most kids isn't the factual stuff they read about sex, even if it's extreme kink shit. It's the stuff they make up about sex in the absence of any real information. The first time I read about somebody being a poop-eating parakeet masturbator, it didn't turn me into a poop-eating parakeet masturbator. It made me go, whoa. Even though I was very young at the time. And I think that hopefully DJ will have the same experience. There was something more relevant I was going to say, but I forgot. Four beers at Wrangler's. Yes? Yes?
About, like,
no, I haven't really studied psychology. I hate to like line up neatly with Tom Cruise, but everybody I know who goes into therapy comes out worse than when they went in. How much therapy did Woody Allen have before he started fucking his daughter? So I'm a little worried. And, you know, I think most people who write in a humorous vein are a little worried about therapy and psychoanalysis, because it makes you not funny anymore. Woody Allen, not funny anymore. I like all my damage, and I found somebody who likes me for my damage, and we don't want to fuck that up by getting too much therapy. Yes?
I just wanted to say, first of all, I haven't read your column yet, and I like your sense of humor. I think it's terrific. And in response to some of what you said, I've recently seen a movie called Me, You, and Everyone We Know.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't seen that movie, in response to this, what you just said about kids, I was kind of shocked myself, but it's a very well-done movie.
A lot of oral sex the kids are having in that movie,
no,
I understand.
But it's also like about the 6-year-old that's telling his brother what to say on an online chat.
I think that's an adult's fantasy about what a 6-year-old is about. Yes, for you? It wasn't really a question. It was, we should all go see You and Me and Everyone We Blow. That movie by... Just kidding. Yes?
Me?
No, you in the back? You. Yes, just shout it out. Those closeted lesbian feminists are so annoying. They drive me right up the fucking wall. I'm so glad finally to meet an out lesbian feminist. No, it's a big deal. Clockamas. I'm just joking. As do I.
Good, 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 good. And I have to say, the column you wrote about red states and blue states, remember that one back a couple of years ago?
Yes.
Published in the Mercury.
Oh, the after the election, the Urban Archipelago piece.
That was not very
public. No, it wasn't, because I was really pissed off. And I actually think that the elites, we urban elites, need to stop being such fucking cringing pussies in the face of these rural idiots who vote against their own class and economic self-interests and then get angry at them when we point that out. I'm totally into like making inroads with rural voters, but actually I kind of think it's not going to really get us anywhere. The Republican Party is sort of shamelessly the party of rural and urban America, and sending Democratic presidential candidates out there to shoot at geese with big fat guns doesn't really kind of make a dent in anything. And I feel like when you look at the map, and I wrote this in Urban Archipelago, you look at the electoral maps, the Democrats are the party of urban America, and they should run toward urban America and be as shamelessly pro-urban as the Republicans are pro-sheep fuckers or whatever is going on out in Clackamas County. And if that upsets Clackamas County to hear, fuck Clackamas County. I'm so sick of, no offense, I'm so sick of being told, hearing from rural America that urban areas are, you know, where all the homos are and every bad fucking, you know, social problem exists and people are, you know, robbers and muggers and rapists and queers and people of color, although that's not how they term it. You know, every social ill, and, you know, we're just bad, 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 hell-bound sinners and you know, latte-sipping motherfuckers. And then when we talk to them, we have to go, oh, we respect your values, love the family farm. And I'm just sick of having to be, like, cringing, fucking, spineless asswipes in the face of this rural assault on urban America. And I mean no disrespect to rural America. I live in a rural area. I live on Vashon Island. It's as big as Manhattan. There are 10,000 people there. And, you know, our Republican next-door neighbors who love us had never seen a homo before we moved in, much less two homos, one who suns himself in a Speedo, and who are the kid. And they're over us now. And that's we should approach them on our terms. And if they're doing something idiotic, I'm just sick of like hearing from rural voters that you told me I was an idiot. Now I'm going to vote for the people who are taking my kids' health insurance away and sending my job to China. That'll show you. It's like, that means you're actually the idiot that I told you. And we should be unabashed and unashamed about spelling it out for them in that way. Well, good, 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 good. So there's nothing in Urban Archipelago that wasn't helpful, because I was just telling them that they are idiots. If you vote for somebody who slits your throat, you're an idiot. If you vote for somebody who doesn't care about you, you're an idiot. If you vote for somebody who ships your job to China and makes sure that no one in your family will ever have health insurance and is the mortal enemy of living wage jobs, you're an idiot. And the elites in the urban area should be a little bit more elitist, because maybe it'll be a little bit more attractive to join the elite here with our health insurance and living wage jobs and lattes and all the other shit that they demagogue about. I just think we should demagogue them right back. But we disagree. You work in Clackamas, I'll work in Seattle, and I'll make it worse, and you'll make it better. And I'm just sick of reaching out to people who spit at me. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of being told that I'm the one with the problem. Well, no, you don't. But the like the people that I'm told I need to reach out to in rural areas are the ones who are like, oh, you're going to hell. And it's like, well, fuck you. I'm sick of being told that I have to like be like nice to people who think I'm going to be tortured and roast in a lake of fire for all eternity. Like, well, fuck you. I hope your kids die of leukemia. Which is one of the things Urban Archipelago is about. You know, I'm sick of as a like urban voter being all worried about safety locks on guns. Urban people don't own guns without safety locks on them or guns at all. Who get their head? What children blow their heads off with daddy's gun at 3 o'clock in the afternoon? Because there's no safety lock. Rural voters. Fuck him. He might not grow up to vote like daddy if he's got no skull. And I know that's harsh, but I was very upset about the election. Just kidding. Any other questions? Yeah? Oh my God! Yeah, I was afraid that would come up. I actually thought the invasion of Iraq would be a really smart thing to do. If you're at my last reading here, we argued about that for a while. I think I was wrong. I think Ted Rall was right. The Stranger commissioned a bunch of pieces from people like Ted Rall and Neil Pollack and Christopher Hitchens and Andrew Sullivan about the sort of run up to the war in Iraq. And Ted Rall said the single most prescient thing, that even if you thought it might be a good idea, that these were not the jackasses to do it, that the Bushies were incompetent, was the word that he used years ago, back when everyone still believed sort of in the CEO president would be competent. And now we find out that the competence thing is not the strong suit of the CEO president, any more than it was the strong suit of the CEOs of Enron or WorldCom or Tyco. I feel very angry about the conduct of the war so far. I think there's actually a new book out. Oh, shit, I should want the clip so I could read from it. There's a new book out by, you know, another liberal hawk, and it wasn't really up to the sex advice columnists of America. You know, Donald Rumsfeld didn't have a little red film under a dome on my desk asking me what I thought. But no one is angrier about the incompetence and the prosecution of this war by the idiots in the Bush administration. But then liberals like me went out on a limb and thought it might be a good idea to take down a fascistic dictator, a la sort of what the left's position on the Spanish Civil War was. It fucking sucks. And I've been grabbing my ankles about it for a year now. It doesn't make me happy. And I hate George Bush so much. And nobody hates him more than those of us who, like, pissed off everyone we know and everyone who buys our books by saying, hey, let's invade Iraq. Did you have a question? Do I have trouble opening up to people? Speaking my mind. No, I actually don't. I do, actually. I'm very shy. Any other questions? Yes?
How was blogging for Andrew Sullivan? Because I really enjoyed what you were doing compared to when he came back. It's like, oh, now we're back to normal.
I love blogging for Andrew Sullivan, but I like blogging for him so much because I really like reading his blog so much. And I like reading John Aravosis' blog, and I like reading Daily Kos. And I like reading The Corner on National Review. But it was fun to blog for him because it was fun to be sort of this counterpoint to him, especially the stuff he let me write. You know, Andrew Sullivan, sometimes people say he's a fascist and he's crazy and all those things. He let me write stuff that was 180 degrees from the stuff that he writes on his blog every day, which just goes to show that he's not this, like, insane conservative asshole that some people like to portray him as. And we're buddies, and we couldn't disagree about more things than we disagree about, starting with Paul Krugman, ending with national health care. Yes? This is an intervention, isn't it? I'm beginning to feel that Portland, you're not all here to hear me read. This is my family's back there. It's about the drinking. I want your marriage for my own. Go ahead.
I'm sort of tossing around this idea, like, am I a crap hole for being married, or should I...
Oh, God, no. No. Like, all those nice straight people out there who are like, because my gay friends can't get married, I shan't. That's very noble and kind of making it all about you, but... just kidding. It actually plays into the hands of conservative opponents of gay marriage if a lot of straight people start saying, we're not going to marry if the gays can't marry. Or if gay people start arguing that no one should have marriage, everyone should have civil unions, and marriage should be a religious ceremony. Because then it's just like, that is what they're saying that we're trying to do. We're trying to pull all of them down to our level instead of, like, pulling ourselves up to their level and having equal treatment. Straight people should get married. I do think that straight people who are pro-marriage equality should mention it during their service, perhaps, or at the reception, perhaps. Not make it into a demonstration, not have, like, rainbow flag waving, you know, performers come out during the service. But a brief mention in an all-day-long extravaganza about the people who are there who are not able to access this legal right would be a nice gesture without it taking over the ceremony. But I don't think straight people shouldn't get married because gay people can't. I think straight people continuing to get married is more evidence that straight gay people should be allowed to. And one of the things I kind of point out in the book, if I may leap from your question to a whole other point, is there's all this talk on the from the religious right that allowing gay people to marry, and I'm sure there's a lot of people from the religious right here tonight, and I'll talk directly to them. And we'll talk about what it means to preach to the choir in a moment. There's this talk that it's going to redefine marriage in this way that's, oh my God, what will it mean, and who knows where it'll end up. And the irony is that marriage has been redefined to a point that it no longer makes any logical sense to exclude same-sex couples. And who did the redefining? Straight people. Marriage used to be one man giving his possession, also known as his daughter, to another man who then possessed that thing as his wife, and he owned her uterus and everything that popped out of it and all of her property. Straight women particularly weren't happy with that setup, nor should they have been. And straight people, to their credit, redefined marriage to be the union of two autonomous individuals in an egalitarian social institution, the parameters of which are defined only by the two people in that marriage. It can be monogamous or not monogamous. There can be kids or no kids. There can be love, honor, and obey, if that's what turns you on, or not. But it's really up to those two individuals, and gender doesn't define marriage. And once you strip the gender definition out of marriage, it makes no sense to exclude same-sex couples from marriage, which is why, when we have these conversations about gay marriage, the religious right gets into these terrible traps trying to talk about it. Because so as not to turn off the majority of voters who don't believe that Leviticus is the Constitution, nor should it be, they have to formulate arguments that aren't grounded in Leviticus, and they can't, unless they want to redefine or predefine or drag straight marriage back to this unhappy place that straight people don't want it dragged back to. Either we're in or you're fucked, basically, is the message to straight people. Either we're in or straight marriage needs to revert back to what it was 100 years ago, which is women don't exist legally unless they are the property of a man as a daughter or a wife. I don't think anybody in this room wants to go back to that. So who am I talking to when I say these things? I actually, somebody confronted me about the preaching to the choir thing, and the only people who say, oh my God, you're preaching to the choir and therefore you should shut up, are lefties. Right-wingers constantly preach to the choir. And right-wing choirs adore being preached to. As a consequence, the right wing has an enormous choir. And the left wing does not. Preaching to the choir puts spine into the choir. It arms your choir with arguments so that they can carry out into the world and beat the shit out of other choir members from other choirs when they happen upon them. The right wing has been doing nothing for 40 years but screaming and yelling and preaching to the choir with their right wing media hit machine, with their right wing radio stations, with their mega churches. And the left has been slow to realize that our choir is small because it's not energized, and shockingly inarticulate where it does exist because they haven't heard the arguments rehearsed again and again and again and again. And now you see, thank God, with things like Air America, you see the left-wing choir sort of coming into existence. And we should not be bashful about wanting to be in the left-wing choir, wanting to preach to that choir, or wanting to be preached to when we're in that choir. It is going to save the fucking country if we can grow our choir. They grew theirs, and they've ruined the fucking country. And so we should not be blah, blah, blah shy about screaming and yelling. Even if we're screaming and yelling in a room full of people who agree with us. It's important that we do that. That's what they've been doing. Yes?
I was just going to ask you about kind of that led you to writing a column.
What was my background that led me to writing a column? I had a degree in theater, and then I lived in Europe for a few years where I sucked a lot of dick. Not that much, actually. It's weird, even, I'm sure all the gay guys in the room who aren't big sluts, isn't it weird how gay guys who aren't big sluts will still joke about being big sluts? I sucked a moderate amount of dick. An appropriate amount of dick. A little German, a little French, a little Spanish, I was done. What was the question? I'm lost in a reverie about the Spanish dick. This does taste like paella. It's so
good. I just
want to
know what you're
asking. I met somebody who was starting a newspaper, and I said, have an advice column. I was advising them to have an advice column. And they said, good advice. Why don't you write it? And I wasn't, it sounds disingenuous now, I wasn't trying to get the job. I'd never written anything before. And it's clear if you read the first couple of years worth of Savage Loves that I had never written anything before. But nothing makes you a writer better and faster than actually having like a vacuum to fill, a hole you have to fill with words every week. And it draws it out of you. And I was just really lucky to meet somebody at the right time and need an advice column. And now my favorite advice column thing is I get to write my advice column at Ann Landers' desk. How many people know I write Savage Love at Ann Landers' desk every week? I went to Ann Landers' auction, the auction of her estate, and bought her desk. I had been in her apartment on Michigan Avenue for 40 years, where she wrote 40 years worth of columns. And now I write my column from her desk, occasionally my boyfriend on her desk, which is more than she ever did. And the funny part is I went to the auction thinking, I'm going to be bidding against the Smithsonian. Like, they're going to buy this and put it next to Archie Bunker's chair. And so I went, and this is like evidence that I make too much money. Writing books and a stupid sex advice column. I took $10,000 out of the bank and thought, I'm just going to go with cash. I'm not going to bring my credit cards because I don't want to spend more than $10,000 in a bidding war against the Smithsonian for Ann Landers desk. So I had $10,000 in cash in my pocket, which had never happened before. I felt like a Medellin cartel courier. I should have wrapped them up in little condoms and swallowed them and had to like shit them out at the auction. And I got there, and I was bidding for the desk, and it cost me $215. I was bidding against one other guy who didn't care that much, apparently, about owning Ann Landers desk. And it cost me $1,000 to ship it home, and I write Ann Landers desk every week, which blows my fucking mind. Any other questions? Yes? Well, they don't say that, invariably. Usually what they say, you know, what do you say, I'll repeat the question, because there's so many people here, it's so terrifying. What do you say to people who say marriage is about procreation, and then when you point out that you don't have to procreate to be married if you're straight, they say that people who don't procreate who are straight shouldn't be married. Where is the movement to deny marriage rights to the infertile? Well, what you say to them is, that's a desperate, last-gasp bullshit argument because there is no movement to deny marriage rights to people who are infertile, who happen to be straight. I mean, I kind of think of homosexuality as a kind of fabulous infertility. It's just the double standard. You know, you have, you know, marriage is about children unless straight people want to get married and not have children, in which case marriage is about the love and the commitment of two individuals to each other. Marriage is about monogamy. We hear that all the time. Unless there's a straight couple who wants to be married without being monogamous, in which case it's not suddenly about monogamy anymore. And the double standards just shouldn't apply only to us. If marriage is only about the safety and protection of children, there are plenty of gay couples with children and plenty of straight couples without. So we should be able to get married. If it's about monogamy, what about all those straight couples who are not monogamous? There's no movement to deny them their marriage rights. Unfortunately, there's a lot of gay people who are out there trying to enforce a double standard from the left, pro-gay marriage. You know, the right says you have to be monogamous to be married. Gay men are not very good at monogamy. Ipso facto, gay people should not be allowed to get married. Lesbians are better at monogamy than gay men or straight couples. So if monogamy is the standard, then only lesbians should be married. But they never follow it through to there. And you don't have to be monogamous to be married if you're straight. You shouldn't have to be monogamous to be married if you're gay. And ironically, it's a lot of pro-gay rights people, I write about them in this book, including my buddy Andrew Sullivan, who I slap around in the book a little bit, who run around saying, well, you know, shouldn't monogamous gay couples be allowed to get married to honor their commitment? And so you see the double standard now being promoted by advocates of gay marriage and promoted by opponents of gay marriage at the same time. It's very sort of weird and distressing. Because I don't think the double standard should apply to us anymore than it applies to straights. And men are terrible at monogamy. Yep.
There was a study that came out a while back about bisexual men where they said...
There aren't any.
Yeah.
We turned over every rock in the garden. Just kidding, bisexual guys.
I was just wondering your opinion.
Well, a lot of people have problems with that study. I think that study showed something that was basically true. Males are less likely to, I think, be bisexual and to identify as bisexual, to respond as bisexual. But there's so many cross currents when you talk about bisexuality, because sexual capacity isn't identity. And you know, I fucked women. Does that make me bi? I don't think so. Some bisexuals think so. Some bisexuals think I should be busted and have to identify as bi because I'm like, you know, thought about Brad Pitt or whoever while I fucked this woman to completion. It's Brad Pitt. He's just really loose. I'm the fourth guy. There's a famous 15th century Islamic poem, which I'll share with you now. Penis soft and round was meant for anus best to match it. Had been meant for Kunis' sake, it'd been shaped just like a hatchet. Which is not to take anything away from the beauty that is a vagina. Here's a funny story. This has always gotten me in trouble, Sevzlov. You're a sex advice columnist, you have to write about strike sex all the time, you have to write about vaginas. I find vaginas terrifying and bizarre. And I shouldn't have to lie about that, I don't think. Because it's an I statement, I find them terrifying and bizarre. Not they are terrifying and bizarre, objectively. Little boys, all little boys, find the body of the other women, girls, kind of strange territory. And bizarre and off-putting. And then little boys hit puberty and all the little straight boys suddenly like vaginas because their testicles command it. And they develop an appreciation for vaginas. They're all little Georgia O'Keefes in the making. The little gay boys never get over the body of the other thing, nor should we have to, nor should we be reprimanded if we're honest about the fact that we didn't. I find vaginas, like, it's like looking at pictures of Mars. Like, wow, they have rocks. Which is not anything. Vaginas, I understand, are beautiful, beautiful things. My brothers rave about them. I find them not so beautiful. And I feel like, you know, as a guy, I shouldn't have to lie about that. Like, if you want to hear a penis described in flowery, revolting ways, ask a dyke to describe a penis. And it doesn't sound like anything but, you know, a garden hose that was left in the sun and covered in scum for 50 years. Nor should it. But I believe that straight guys should love vaginas, and I beat the shit out of straight guys who won't just press their faces right into them in my column, even though I won't. One of the earliest savage loves that ever got me in shitloads of trouble. It must be like 4 o'clock in the morning. I wonder when I'm supposed to stop talking. My colleges have to pay me millions of dollars to just do what I'm doing right here for you now for free. Soak it up. One of the funniest, earliest columns Savage Love got me in trouble when I realized I was dancing on strange territory was somebody, you know, reprimanded me for something sort of vaguely gynophobic was the word they applied to me. I said about vaginas. I was like, well, what do I know about vaginas? Like, to me, they look like a canned ham dropped from a great height. And I actually thought that was sort of a beautiful image. Not kosher, but beautiful. Because if you dropped like a Hormel from the top of the Sears Tower in Chicago, it would spin and fall and spin and fall. Eventually it would hit the pavement and like one seam on the can would split and then all the meat would kind of like flower out of it in this beautiful pink George O'Keefe sort of way. And if you ever drop something from a great height, you know that it is very symmetrical when it hits the ground. And I just thought it would be this beautiful little pink meat origami flower thing. But I pissed off the lesbian feminist Jewish community, I guess, by saying. Did you ask? Yes?
Not as interesting as sex. but do you have time to read fiction? And if so, who do you like to read?
I don't read fiction, and I'm one of those people who just feels like the world right now is so bizarre that I read things that are made up, and I'm just like, Jesus Christ, I can't do this. I have to get back to the real world, which couldn't be stranger. But I've never really been into fiction. I'm one of those weirdos who read the Bible when he was 14 years old and then read Rise and Fall of the Third Reich when he was 15 years old. So I'm sort of a nonfiction weirdo for my back. Read Fruit by Brian Francis, or The Strange Fruit of Peter Paddington. This is the last novel I read and I loved it. Yes, way in the back. People don't seem so concerned about AIDS, and they aren't, and nor should they be, because it is less concerning than it used to be. Still a huge fucking problem, and we should all be vigilant, but it is not the freak-out-a-thon it was in the 80s and 90s. What people should be concerned about, what we don't talk about when we talk about AIDS, and what the agencies, particularly the ones that serve gay men, don't talk about, the ones that serve straight people should talk about the risks that straight people really face. And should really be concerned about, that are less tied to multi-partnerism, which is a lot of what fuels the AIDS epidemic in America, which is HPV and pregnancy. And if you're taking steps to prevent yourself from getting gonorrhea, syphilis, HPV, and pregnant, if you're straight, you're pretty much protected from HIV. The problem is not so much, you know, we know a lot about HPV now, we know how it's transmitted, there's a lot of treatments, there's a new breakthrough every day, we understand the virus in a way that we didn't 20 years ago. The problem and the thing we don't discuss is the emergence of a hitherto-for unknown, fatal, sexually transmitted disease is a known consequence of a degree of promiscuity that we should never bring back. That's what they don't tell the fags. They tell the fags it doesn't matter how many people you have sex with, it matters how you have sex with them. Or that, you know, once we have a vaccine, it can be 1978 at the mineshaft again. And it can't ever be 1978 at the mineshaft again. Because the next fatal sexually transmitted disease that we lay out the welcome mat for may not be as hard to transmit as HIV is. And we need to be cautious and careful about that. Like we created, Michael Callan in his book Surviving AIDS said, the disease settings that allowed HIV to explode. And we can't recreate those disease settings. Not because they'll allow HIV to explode again, but because they'll allow the next one to explode. The idea that there are no more of where this came from is irrational and nutso. And that's what we should be telling people, that it can't be 1978 again, and that we should be cautious and careful. We shouldn't be locked up in the suburbs. One of the things I get, and maybe I should end with this because it's 3 a.m., unless you want to keep talking. One of the things I get when I, you know, get married or have a baby, is that I somehow think that, you know, all gay men should, like, pull up their pants and move to the suburbs and zip up their zippers and put on chastity belts and, you know, lead lives as depressing and squalid as straight people do or have. And I actually don't think that's the case. I do think that straight people should have more sex and more sex partners than they do. And gay people should have less sex than we can. And that somewhere there's a wise balance that we haven't yet found our way to. And one of the reasons we haven't found our way to is a little bit of gay supremacism, because a lot of gays look at straight people and think there's nothing there. There's nothing in, like, the straight universe that applies to my sex life or has any meaning or import or wisdom or insight. And it's not true. You know, when you look at sort of gay guys who are out of control sexually, or straight people do, often what you hear is like, oh my God, what's wrong with gay people? And it's not really about being gay, it's about being male. There would be heterosexual bathhouses if women would, but women won't. And really, what is a gay bathhouse but a whorehouse staffed by volunteers? Women won't have sex in the park in the middle of the night under a bush with somebody who they can't see. Men will. Gay or straight, they will. But only gay guys can. And so they do. And so when we look at, like, gay life versus straight life, and one of the things I think this book is about is the breakdown in, like, gay life versus straight life. I am sort of married, and although we are not monogamous, which I talk about in this book, much to the consternation of some gay rights groups, the non-monogamy is by circumstances so prescribed that we might as well be monogamous, but my brother is non-monogamous and he's in a heterosexual relationship. If you described my relationship and my brother's relationship and left out the genders, you would think my brother was the gay brother and I was the straight one. So what does gay or straight even mean? And blah, blah, blah. Actually, I derailed myself from my previous point, which was the thing we don't talk about in AIDS prevention, the thing we don't talk about like among gay people and like trying to right-size gay life or gay sex lives is, you know, you look at what makes straight men not necessarily spin out of control, or spin out of control in more controlled ways, or spin out of control less often. It's women. Female sexual reserve, whether you believe it is culture or biological to some degree, wherever you think female sexual, I'm not going to have sex with guys under bushes in the dark that I can't see, wherever that comes from, it exists, and it acts as a check on heterosexual male licentiousness. There is no external check on homosexual male licentiousness. We, gay guys, we have to find our inner canned hams. Because they're not imposed on us. And if we don't find them inside, poor Mel, how are you? If we don't find it inside, we spin out of control, just as every straight guy in America would if they didn't find it outside. And that's what they never talk about in HIV/AIDS prevention education for gay men, is that there is a limit, that there's enough, that enough is as good as a feast, which is a line from Mary Poppins, my favorite movie musical. And we're not encouraged to sort of view sex that way. We're not encouraged to look at gay sex or gay relationships and think, you know, there is that moderating thing that the right wing talks about, that moderating role that female sexuality and female sexual reserve plays in the lives of straight men. There's something to that. That actually works. To the benefit of society, to the benefit of straight relationships, and we need to get a little bit of that in the gay relationships. And acknowledging as gay people sometimes what works about heterosexual relationships feels dicey. We feel like we can't acknowledge that there's anything there that we don't have or that's better or that sort of like has a built-in sort of sensibility that we might want to adopt. But we should do that unashamedly. We should borrow from them because they have borrowed. How many straight people are here tonight? Because they have borrowed from us, which is in the book. So many straight people today live gay lives, up to a point. And the point is usually 36 or 37. You look at straight lives today, this whole like straight people moving into inner city, sort of funky, interesting neighborhoods like the Pearl, and having a lot of sort of transitory brief sex. Hooking up is just straight for fuck buddy or anonymous sex. Straight people live gay lives until their 30s. And what's so interesting about this time in our lives as gay people and straight people is that straight people saw how gay people were living in the 60s and 70s and 80s and thought, even with AIDS, I want some of that. I don't want to get married at 22 and move to the suburbs and die inside. I want to have some fun while I'm young and single and have an apartment and a credit card and some skin layers of skin to spare. And gay people looked at straight people and thought, you know what, when I'm 35 or 40, I don't want to be doing sit-ups and be in the bars anymore because it gets exhausting. And there's been this great sort of swap where you see straight people filling the cities and living like only gay people lived in the cities two generations ago. And you see gay people now living like straight people only lived in middle age. And there's something to that gay, that straight middle-aged life. Not taking anything away from the gay 20s to 35-year-old life. It's awesome fucking a lot of people and having fun. But there's something to, like, taking your place in the flow of generations, taking your place in family life. Because you know what? Nobody likes to do sit-ups in their 50s. And it works, this family life thing. There's something to it. We don't have to reinvent life from soup to nuts if we're gay or lesbian. We were excluded from these institutions and these roles as family and family members and marriage. Not because we were incapable of performing these roles, but because we were tossed out. And straight people were excluded from fun. Not because they were incapable of fun or even a bisexual experience every once in a while. Because they excluded themselves from them. And now there's this great sort of co-mingling, and it's a really exciting time to be queer, and it's a really exciting time, consequently also, to be straight. and we should document this and wonder what it's like and write things down about it. And I'm going to keep talking until 3 o'clock in the fucking morning. This is the curse of the Irish. Any final question? Make it a good one.
The ring you're wearing, is it the skull?
Yes. Any other final questions? Yes? I'm going to be on Bill Maher again, I think, in January, they said. That's a shitty final question. Any other final question? No, it's a great final question. It's just so self-serving.
Does your family enjoy your column?
Does my family enjoy my column? Oh, that's a really good final question. We'll end there. Blah, blah, blah. Hooping and hoopin' him. 4 beers, and this is what you got. I wet my pants, but I'll keep talking. My family enjoys my column to a point. And here's the point I reached with my mother once, and it's a great anecdote, and I'll shut up. I got a question once. What's the difference between blowjobs, cocksucking, and fellatio? That's a very cute, funny, sort of like question. I get them all the time. And so I ran it. I thought, oh, you know, my response would be, blowjobs are something my sister gives, cocksucking is something my boyfriend does, and fellatio is an act my mother performs. And I thought it was illustrative of how, like, different kinds of people are comfortable with different kinds of terms. If you called my mother a cocksucker, she'd have a problem with that. If you call my boyfriend a cocksucker, he gets aroused. And so I ran it, and it didn't occur to me, or I didn't remember, although my mother refuses to believe me to this day, that the column that week, this is like 9 years ago, was going into the Chicago Reader for the first time. And my mother lives in Chicago, and she worked at a university where she told all of her students and all of her friends pick up the Reader, Danny's going to be in the Reader. And I'm not that organized to keep track of when a paper starts running me or not, so but she still refuses to believe that I didn't do that on purpose. But I didn't, and she refuses to believe, and she wants me to stop talking about it at lectures. It's too much fun. So thank you all for coming and packing this sweaty room, and thanks to Powell for having me back.
Sign books, we'll form a line on that side of the room. On your right hand side of the room, try to make it as orderly as possible. There are some books back there in that group of people.
It's about 8:45 in the evening at Powell's Books in downtown Portland. We just heard Dan Savage talk in a talk that I believe that you'll enjoy for a long time. Going on Cable News.